You're listening to On Margins. I'm Craig Maad, and this is Season 2, Episode 1. Yes, that is right. After an 18-month hiatus, we have a new episode of On Margins. I know, it's been a long time. And it's with one of my very favorite humans and writers in the whole world, Sam Anderson, author of the book Boomtown and staff writer for New York Times Magazine. Man, Sam is just one of those dudes who has such an inviting voice. He's kind and funny and empathetic and brilliant. And when you read his stuff, you just feel the care. It oozes with care. It cares too much. In fact, we talk about how much this care is a problem in his work because it can crush you. You can be crushed by care. And Sam is sometimes crushed by care. This episode was actually recorded in March 2020, right at the start of the pandemic. I think we had been in lockdown for like 10 days at this point. So we talk about that and we discuss how to be radically present in the face of horrific and terrifying news that is always at your fingertips. We talk about how cliches are the bedrock of humanity. We try to give a little bit of writing advice, but it's all cliches in the end. And we talk about how a single paragraph of Annie Dillard can set your mind ablaze. So come join us. It's been a long time, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Good morning, Sam Anderson.
Hi, Craig.
How you doing?
Good evening.
Good evening. It's good to see you.
Yeah, it's nice to see you.
Where are you right now?
Well, I feel like people say this a lot in podcasts. They say they're sitting in like a closet or their basement or something, but it's kind of like telling someone your dream, like nobody really cares. But I actually am sitting in a teeny tiny closet that the family knows refers to as the Harry Potter closet in our house. And I've set up a synthetic like wolf fur blanket that's hanging down and to muffle the sound. And I'm talking to a microphone.
I love it. Well, you look amazing. Looks sad.
Thanks. I'm wearing a bathrobe and a sweatshirt and my pajama pants, which I think I've been wearing for about 6 days now.
So, it's so hard not to talk about this thing, but just to like give some context to like what's happening in the universe.
I mean,
right? So why haven't you changed for 6 days? What's going on?
Because we're all tumbling through the great formlessness. The complete absence of structure of self-quarantine, right?
It's true. There's no...
Of the coronavirus.
There's no rules. I'm laughing just because it's like you have to be so diligent about taking off your pajamas.
You do. If that's the rule, there's argument on Twitter about whether changing does that much for you, about which are the key like triggers and routines that create structure as you're tumbling through the void. But yeah, it comes down to a lot of like willpower and discipline. And it turns out that like I have that in elite quantities under very, very specific circumstances. And this is not one of them so far.
When do those qualities rise?
I don't know. This is something I really struggle with is like, I don't know, you know, things that fit under, I just think of the term executive function and like the little homunculus who lives in your brain, who's like in charge of stuff and how to make that person stronger. I've been reading a lot about ADHD lately. I don't know if I have it, but I've always struggled with the things kind of related to ADHD. And I feel like our whole society right now is melting down in a kind of ADHD way. But this is a particularly hard moment to try to focus and get things done. And it happens to be coinciding with the moment in our cultural history in which we're all going crazy with lack of focus because of these phones and screens and the like the tiny loops that are built into them, the kind of crazy making little loops. So it's a particularly fraught, kind of freaky moment in terms of getting stuff done and paying attention, right? How are you finding it?
Man, I've got a, you know, I wake up in the morning and I've got to run. I literally like run away from the internet. I have to just like bolt into a space where, you know, there's no, I don't touch my office sort of space, you know, or don't even look in the direction of the phone.
What do? You get out of bed.
I get out of bed. And
you don't grab your phone from under your pillow and check Instagram.
Yeah, the phone, you know how you have those helmets with like beer cans on them? I have a helmet that where it holds two phones in front of my eyes, and that's how I sleep.
I mean, that's not far from the truth for a lot of people, I think.
Man, well, I would love. I mean, there's a part of me that's just like, let's jack in, man. Let's just keep going forever. But no, I wake up and I'm running out of the room to the kitchen to just like do anything that makes me feel like I've won the first 3 minutes of the day. I'm like, I just got to win these first 3 minutes.
Right, right.
It's tough. It is. It's really, really tough. But, you know, it's heartening to know that we're all sort of struggling with this together. You know, it's.
Yeah, I think that is actually a great, like, unifying, cheering thing. That always happens, like, when I talk to people about writing and I talk to them about how hard it is for me to write.
Yeah.
And sometimes people are surprised. And I remember, like, oh, yeah, not everybody knows that. And people have these fantasies about other people and their productivity and their like mastery of the tiny details of life, and they generally are not true.
So Sam Anderson doesn't just sit down and 2 weeks later a book is done. That's not how Sam Anderson works.
Oh man, the worst. It's the worst. It's the opposite of that. I struggle so much with it, and I always have, with finishing things, with deadlines. Mm. I'm getting like anxious in my closet right now saying these words. Yeah, it's just been a constant struggle. And, you know, one consolation is that like every writer I've ever talked to, that's pretty much true for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I've had, I'm like sitting right now on like treasure troves of reporting and experiences that I've had for many months that are so precious to me, and they're, you know, they need to be turned into like the greatest pieces I've ever written, and I haven't been able to do it yet. So I'm like very behind on many projects that are like the greatest projects of my life.
Well, yeah. how do you start to break that down? How do you start to go from this place of paralysis and the perfection of the thing to be made that isn't yet made, to starting to crack at it and make the ugly, disgusting first baby that, you know, pops out when you start to work on this stuff? What's your strategy?
I mean, part of what's demoralizing here is that there are no like fresh, cool insights. It's all cliches all the way down. And I think as someone who like, you know, who like grew up wanting to be sort of an intellectual and have interesting thoughts, that's offensive on a daily and moment-to-moment basis, that the thoughts are all the most boring thing you could ever say about any of this.
Right.
So it's like, you know, man, you just got to sit down and just keep starting. Don't worry about finishing. Just start. Just sit down for 15 minutes, set your timer and focus for 15 minutes. And then, you know, more likely than not, you'll get carried away and it'll be like an hour and you'll look up and you'll be, and, you know, you just do that again and again. It's all about putting your butt in that chair.
It's true.
Banging out that shitty first draft. And like, it's all the dumbest stuff you could ever say, but it's the most true.
It is. That's true. Well, I ran into your work through New York Times Magazine and through Boomtown, and then I was going back through the New York period of Sam Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
And you got that Bloom piece. I mean, that guy did not have any problems writing.
Harold Bloom?
Yeah.
Did I write something about Harold Bloom?
Maybe that was for the New York Times Magazine.
Oh, yeah. That was recent. That was for, because he died, for the Lives They Lived. And I've always had an incredible suspicion and animosity towards people who don't have trouble writing.
Right.
I'm very suspicious of Harold Bloom.
What's going on there?
Well, there's a certain, also someone like Christopher Hitchens.
These
people set off alarm bells for me.
Yeah.
I think there's some large percentage of them that is doing a shtick, that is doing, like, in the case of Hitchens, like this sort of humanist, omnipotent, you know, like Edwardian confident British scholar voice that's largely just sort of a puppet show, a stylistic puppet show, rather than an actual human intelligence that's sort of searching itself and searching the world for really interesting, new, true things to say. There's like a sort of dance or performance that happens, and that gets a lot of writing done. I don't know. I have no right to be judgmental of anybody. They're getting their writing done.
Judge away. They're dead.
Some people are just like, people are just like smart and like fecund. What'd you say? We're dead?
I said, they're dead. Who cares?
Judge. Oh, they're dead. We're dead. It's over. Civilization is over. I'm huddled in my closet. No, I have this. The last thing I bought before the pandemic hit was this large black journal from a local office supply shop. And I actually have been writing in it every day.
Okay.
And by hand. Writing by hand is one thing that works for me.
Well, and also.
And I've been drawing pictures.
Yeah, I was going to say, you gave me your book and you made a little drawing in the book. I feel like drawing is a key part of your very existence, Sam.
Do the pages sound good flipping on this microphone?
It's a very meaty page.
I do love paper, yeah. Actually, that's a way. Oh, shit.
Uh-oh. I don't know. The door opened. Don't let that
actually, getting down on paper, not to sound like too old a guy, but interacting physically with a sheet of paper and doing free writing is actually where a lot of the anxiety starts to ease up for me and a lot of writing comes out.
Right.
So if I can get away from screens and typey things and just put a pencil or a pen to an actual piece of paper, then good things happen.
Yeah. Well, I find, I don't know if this is true for you, but for me, the whole kind of seduction of the paper is just, there's nothing behind it, right? It's like whenever I sit down at the computer to work on something that requires focus, and this could be like photo editing, it could be, you know, working on an essay, it could be laying out a book or whatever. Like, I just feel the conflict of all the crap that the other crap that the machine can do. It's like, you can just do so much other stuff on this thing. Why am I doing this one, you know, and you're kind of pulled in that way. So I have my own weird, you know, ways to put boundaries around stuff using like the Freedom app to kind of block basically anything fun on the internet. And I find that really helps. But like you, I mean, man, it's so weird to sit down with like a good notebook, especially a big one. Like, I like that your notebook there was so big.
Yep. Another thing, another old-timey tool that works great is a typewriter, I've found, because I have a couple of them and I do use them for writing sometimes. And it just, it does, like, it like cuts the cord of insanity that connects you to the digital world.
Right.
And it creates, it's a writing machine that only moves forward.
Right.
And it creates this thing that is a piece of writing and only a piece of writing. And there's something powerful to me about how there's no copies of it. Like you can't send it off. You can't email it off. You can't print out new versions of it. It's just like it is coterminous with itself. It is like a perfect little shred of being, this piece of writing that you created.
Right, right.
So I think it's cool, but maybe that's annoying and hipstery.
I think it's annoying in a hipstery way if you don't actually write a book with it. But I think if you knock something out, then it's great. The thing I like about a typewriter, I've got one sitting over there in Olivetti.
What kind?
Man, I don't know. I bought it.
I've got the Latura 22.
That may be the one I have too. I got it on Yahoo Auction like 7 years ago.
How much did you pay?
Oh, not a lot. It was like 70, 80 bucks.
Nice.
I don't know. It felt like it was a good deal. And you know what I like? I like slamming the period into paper. Boom.
Okay.
I love that. I've got,
and
I got really like very soft paper. So it's almost like the back of it ends up feeling like Morse code after typing on it.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I love that.
Yeah.
And then what's great.
Yeah, I mean, you're writing, you're using your body to do your writing, which of course we always are and should be.
Right.
But we get so, I find on my worst days, I get so abstracted and so like detached from my body and my surroundings. And that's a way to get yourself back in, to slam that period.
It's so, just something satisfying about. And then at the end of the day, you've got a little stack of stuff, which I find reassuring. I mean, it's like you say, it's only one copy of it, which is kind of unique. But like, there's like a physical,
it's literally unique.
There's just a thing that you can point at and go, okay, that was done today in a way that I just don't find word count on a computer to be as satisfying.
Yeah, I agree.
It's not very
hard to send to your editor.
So
then you have to, I mean, there comes a point where you have to convert this beautiful physical handwriting or typewriting that you do into a digital version. I haven't like fully committed to the bit where I like type everything out and revise it and type it again and then like paperclip it and mail it to my editor. It always becomes a computer file. And then that's kind of where the trouble starts.
Right. Well, let's talk about Boomtown. That's your book.
That's my book, yeah. And that went through all these processes that we're talking about. A lot of handwriting.
Okay.
And then actually what does keep me grounded in the revision, and I could show you a 4-foot-tall stack of papers that I have that are just hand-revised pages from drafts of Boomtown sections. I always print out and then just sit with a pencil or pen and hand-revise the printouts. And then that's where like a lot of the creativity and the best phrases sort of bloom in the margins and between lines. And then I go type all that back in and then I print it out again. And I do that again like 100 times.
Mm-hmm. Like literally.
Until I can read a page, maybe more like literally between 10 and 20.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but really into whatever it takes until I can read a page and not want to change anything.
Right.
And that was always the standard. Back before I had hard deadlines, when I was just trying to make a writing career, that was the standard, was I would work on a piece of writing until I could read it like infinite times and not see a thing to change.
And you find you get to that place?
Not anymore, because I have these deadlines. Right. But I do, yeah. Left to my own devices, yeah, I do get to that place.
Wow.
Well, yeah.
You say you have deadlines now, but I feel like you kind of have this... what from the outside seems like a fairly fluid relationship with the New York Times Magazine, where you're not being you don't have like a monthly thing that you're trying to hit, but
no,
but you do have deadlines.
You're burning me pretty hard right now. I mean, this is like symptomatic of my failure. I'm a staff writer and I do have deadlines. They get past, and then it seems like I'm very casually dropping pieces whenever I feel like it.
It does. From the outside, it feels very improv jazz, but that's not the...
I think I get a certain amount of leeway because I care so much and I agonize so hard about everything, and my editors feel bad for me. So I have a longer rope than a lot of writers. I'm very, very, very lucky to have this job and to be working with this team of people who are so like empathetic and understanding. But yeah, I do have deadlines. But no, not like a monthly thing. I mean, for a while
you had new sentences.
I was doing, yeah, I had this little mini column called New Sentences,
which
where I was
great. So much fun.
Thank you. Yeah, I was really happy with it. So the premise was, and this was an idea from Jake Silverstein, the editor in chief of the New York Times Magazine, who essentially wanted to solve this problem of not allowing me to spiral off into the formless void, and to have, in this case, a weekly deadline for this like mini piece. And they're like 300 words, which is like nothing.
Right.
And it was brilliant because it didn't allow me to procrastinate and float away. And it was short enough that I didn't have to really freak out. Like, I can do 300 words. And I had a whole routine where, so the premise of the column was I would just take one sentence from some newish book that had been published in the last 6 months or so and write a mini essay about whatever. And I could go in any direction I wanted. I could do like stylistic analysis of the sentence. I could do like free associative prose poetry. and it was super fun. And that was one where I really got a rhythm going. I'd read a book, and then I'd like make a long list of potential sentences from it. I would type into my computer and I'd print those out, and then I'd like pick the sentence and start free writing, and then I'd just produce this little 300 word essay. And that was great fun. And the amazing thing about it was it had like a very like strong, very small following, but it just died online. It did nothing online. And that's not allowed anymore.
Why do you think it didn't have legs online?
I have no idea. I've stopped trying to pretend that I know what is popular or interesting to people. Really, like, I have no idea. I would think this thing would like explode across the internet. I mean, I wrote a whole book about, you keep trying to talk about it, I wrote a whole book about Oklahoma City, which nobody cares about. This is a larger thought, but I think I steeped myself in a tradition of reading and writing. And what really got me excited when I was growing up and wanting to be a writer was writing about really trivial things that nobody cares about. There's like this great like tradition of English essays from like the 18th century and 19th centuries of like people writing about the most trivial possible things. You're like G.K. Chesterton, who wrote, you know, this book, All Things Considered, where he writes essays that are like on running after one's hat.
Right.
Or like on a piece of chalk. And he's just like drawing with a piece of chalk and describing what that's like. I love that stuff. Mm. And I always wanted to do that. Or like Nicholson Baker. I don't know if you know him.
Oh, but yeah.
Yeah, Nicholson Baker, who's like
amazing. The Mezzanine, the anthologist.
Yeah, right. Yeah. The Mezzanine, his first novel, which is an entire short novel that takes place in like a 15-minute stretch when a guy is riding the escalator back to work from his lunch break and all the things he thinks about.
I love his analysis of straws in that book. He's got a whole section on straws. Just goes into
it. Yeah, and he's got like a 10-page footnote about like how stapler design has always like tracked 10 years behind like locomotive design or something. He's just an insane genius of like the triviality of life. And
he's got
I've always been so inspired by that tradition. And so I pick things that are deliberately not universally appealing because it seems like a cheat and kind of boring to me to write about like Beyonce.
Right.
Who everybody's already thinking about. I want to make people interested in things they're not already thinking about. But it turns out that's a liability when you want your mini column to blow up online.
Well, I mean, Nicholson Baker, by the way, also has a great Twitter account. I don't know if you're following him.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Really good. Really weird. Super weird in a good way. In the best way. But like when I found new sentences, I just ate them all up. I just spent an evening reading them all, because you can kind of do that.
Really?
Yeah, man. I was like, this is great. I mean, I loved the weirdness, the zaniness of it. Because like you said, you just go off. Every single essay is a little bit different. You know, it maybe has nothing to do with the sentence. In some ways, I mean, it goes so far away from the sentence or from the book that for me, it was just like, oh, wow, you can go to that distance from the starting point in 300 words, because that was the other impressive thing about it, is it's a short column, but the ground you cover is, in some of those little essays, really expansive. And so actually that new sentences column inspired me to start my Ridgeline newsletter. So that,
really?
Yeah, that was the,
oh, I didn't know that.
That was like the direct spark of inspiration. I was reading that and I was like, this is great. I love this. The strictness of the form, the kind of weirdness of it, the playfulness of it, the fact that you weren't bound by any specific, you know, structure or topic. And I just thought, yeah, man, I can do that with walking. I was like, I'm just going to every week. And I love the rhythm of it weekly. And I was like, all right, this is my task. I have to write a weekly walking newsletter. And it ended up focusing on Japan, just because that's where I'm doing a lot of my walking. But it totally drew inspiration from new sentences. I was just like, that's an archetype.
Wow.
I love it.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So, but you have much success online in a way new sentences did not.
Well, if you were writing new sentences about Japan, I bet you'd have had more hits.
Oh, really?
It's kind of a cheat to write
about
Japan.
That's like a jet fuel of attention for people.
Yeah, man.
Excitement.
People just like Japan. They're just kind of.
When you say people, do you mean American people?
Do you mean people? I don't know. It just seems like everyone's kind of like pretty willing to click on anything that has Japan in it. That'll be a little bit fun. So I think that's like kind of a built-in cheat. I think. It is funny, though, the deadline thing, because I up until I started doing Ridgeline, so but like basically 15 months ago is when I was like, all right, I'm going to make everything, I'm going to give everything deadlines. I found that to be critical. I published 150,000 words last year on my newsletters. And
that's a lot.
I know. Well, and most, absolutely the most I've ever written and put out there in a year. And entirely because of just the deadlines, just get it done. Anyway, I found that to be really, really critical. And now I'm trying to go back through all this stuff and figure out, okay, where, how do I rearrange this into kind of a book form, bits and pieces of this, which is, I'm already feeling like I'm collapsing under the weight of even the the thought of looking through it.
Yeah, that's a lot of words.
It is. It's a lot of stuff. But I'm interested in how you made the jump, because you've written about a bunch of interesting people and places, and how you made this jump to commit whole hog to Oklahoma City, because you don't have a family connection there. You didn't grow up in the South.
Zero.
And literally until I got your book, I don't think I had ever read anything about Oklahoma City in my life. And even the only thing I remembered was the bombing in the 90s. But I was almost too young to recognize even what was happening. I remember, I have this vague memory of being in a motel, probably in Florida. When did the bombing happen? In the summer?
It was April 95.
I was on some weird vacation in a motel, and I met with my mom and my grandparents, and I remember it being on the TV, and that's about it. That's the only...
What year were you born?
80.
Okay. So I was 77. I was in high school. And I remember it just as this giant, you know, this giant tragedy, like things that happen all over all the time. But it was a bigger deal to us because it was in the United States and it was on the news for many days. And that was kind of it. And yeah, I had no connection to Oklahoma City. People often assume I'm from there or something. But no, it was, again, it was one of these like deliberately perverse choices to write about something that people have not read about before,
right,
or cared about before, and to explore then what this huge untapped reservoir of material and of, more than that, like there's something that excites me about like the untapped reservoir of caring, I guess.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I don't think I've framed it like that to myself before, but
yeah,
there's something experimental and thrilling to me about caring as hard as a human can care about something that is completely disrespected and ignored by like the machinery of cultural attention.
Yes. Yes. I mean, okay. A lot of your work is not explicitly political, but when you frame it like that, to me, that feels like a deliberate political or philosophical sort of stake in the ground.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, I think a lot about when I watch the current American president, and he has this particular obsession with, I mean, part of the way that, one of the ways he's like trapped in amber back in the 1980s is he uses the word ratings all the time to describe everything. Like, very low ratings, very bad ratings. And it's like, that's such an old fashioned metric. It like doesn't even make sense anymore. But to me, I think about that word a lot, ratings.
Right.
And I think about this obsession with like numbers and with numbers culture. And today it would be clicks or hits or downloads or whatever. And I think there's just a certain insanity inherent in numbers culture. There's like an adolescent kind of insanity and paralysis inside of this fetishization of numbers and of other people's attention.
Right.
in a quantifiable way, you know? Right. So I think of literature and I think of the act of reading and of writing as these kind of magic spaces that are both private and public at the same time.
Yeah.
But in a way that's very, 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 very different from this whole notion of ratings or numbers culture, as I've come to think of it. And yeah, it's like, this is not a new thought at all, but it's like this holy space. It's like the literary space is like this holy, sacred space where some kind of magic transfer happens. So that probably is political. I mean, there's something essentially human about it, to use a word that's hard to define and that's been kind of debased. But I think, yeah, if I do have an agenda, it's something about humans realizing their full humanness and connecting with one another on some deep human level.
Yeah.
That certainly the economy of attention, if you want to put it like that, does not encourage these days. And so literature to me has always been kind of a little cheat code to get there. And so that's what I was trying to do. So yeah, to choose Oklahoma City was, again, this deliberate act of rebellion, I think, against obviousness. And then I thought, well, what you do is, as Nicholson Baker does, or a lot of my literary heroes do, is you pick this thing that seems unpromising to a casual reader, and then you pour so much devotion and attention into it and energy and creativity that you make it irresistibly fascinating to everybody.
Yeah.
So that was the aim with the book, and that's always kind of the aim with my writing in general. I think writing has to be like really special to justify the time that you're asking people to spend with it, especially today.
Yeah.
Like it has to be really special.
Yeah.
On a word by word, sentence by sentence level. And so I tried to make the book really special. And I think what I underestimated is how big a hurdle it would be to the general reader to say, here, read this book about Oklahoma City. Trust me, it'll be really special and amazing. And you don't think you care right now, but you're going to care.
Right.
I didn't realize that was just a switch that gets flipped that turns off 99.99% of humanity.
Well, I mean, honestly, like, I don't know. If I definitely would not pick up a book on Oklahoma City randomly, I wouldn't just go, oh, yeah, let me go for that one. I mean, I think I was receptive to it because I knew your work and I kind of felt that sense of care. And I think for a lot of folks that they're reading someone, their voice resonates with them, you just want more of it. You know, it's like you just go through these, you're like, okay, how do I get more Sam in my head? Because it's like, you, like you're saying, you do feel this care. Like, you know, when you write about Rick Steves, like you really are interested, like, in Rick Steves and his ethos and his philosophy and why he's traveling through Europe and what he's, you know, how he's thinking about his entire life built around, you know, activating people's travel impulse or whatever. Actually, he may be the reason for the corona problem. But
because he's circulating humanity.
He's, man, we should all be staying home. But
and he's based in the northern suburbs of Seattle, where like the first hotspot was in the United States.
It's all coming together.
It's funny. I was supposed to fly out next week, I think, to do a whole Pacific Northwest trip. One big portion of which was staying with Rick Steves at his house, hanging out.
Oh man.
Yeah, I had to cancel.
Smoking some Rick Steves doobies.
I would hope so. That was the joke in my family, but you know, I'd follow his lead. But yeah,
but like Boomtown. So like, you know, when you start reading it, and yeah, I mean, Jesus, man, you just really, you obviously care, and if someone really gives a shit, and they have a strong voice, and they've clearly put in the work to, like, you know, whatever, sand away the bullshit, I'm gonna hang out wherever you want to take me. So it's just that sort of entry energy of like, Oklahoma City, do I really want to read 400 pages on Oklahoma City? But then once you start going with it, what's amazing about Boomtown is like it contains all of the things I care least about in the world, like basketball. I've literally, I've never watched a basketball game ever in my life, ever.
Really?
I've never, ever, ever, ever. The only basketball people I can name are like Michael Jordan and Larry Bird. That's kind of like all I know. Maybe Shaq.
Okay.
That's it. I've got, that's I'm done. I have no more basketball people. And yet I was with you the whole time. I was in. I was totally.
That's great. That's my favorite thing that people say to me about the book is like.
Totally with it.
I had no interest in Oklahoma City, basketball, urban planning, et cetera, et cetera. But I love the book.
Yeah.
I mean, that's because that's like the trick, right? Is you want to be able to make everything interesting, literally everything interesting.
Yeah. I was rereading big chunks of it over the last couple of days. And, you know, I think one of the things you do so well that keeps pulling you forward is it's just funny. It's a hilarious book. Like you do this walk, you know, obviously I have this kind of walk obsession and you do this walk from the pot line, you know, POTT line back into town. You're walking the land rush, which in and of itself is just insane and hilarious and something I didn't know had happened. I feel like everyone in America should know about land rushes.
It's for sure.
So
yeah.
Weird and American. But you're walking, you know, you're walking whatever highway it was, 42 or 64 or something. And
62, I think. It was, yeah.
And you see this sign, thief beware, traps have been set. Enter at your own risk. to me.
Yeah. On Edie's Chicken House, wasn't that? Yeah.
That's the greatest detail of anything. Like that's it. That, you know, I'll read it. I'll read the entire book just knowing thief beware, traps have been set, enter at your own risk. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So good.
So, thanks. I mean that was one of my favorite parts of the experience was I've been writing about all this history and urban planning and this kind of vast collective experience over many decades, and there came this significant day, which was the anniversary of the land run, April 22nd. And I was like, I got to do something to commemorate this, to like experience this. And I decided a little impulsively to do this walk. It turned out to be about a 20-mile walk, which is nothing by your standards. But for me, it was a long one.
20
it
miles is long.
Day and,
that's and, a marathon. Basically.
And the great thing about it, as you know from doing your epic walks, is like, and this goes right back to what we were talking about before. You're putting your body through a space that is not designed for a body to move through it. Like you're moving it. Like this road was not designed for walking and nobody, I'd be surprised if anyone else had walked it. Maybe not. But it's not something you do. There's no sidewalks. There's no, people are just driving. People are yelling out the windows of their cars because they're like, what the hell are you doing? So you're like resisting the bullying of this culture that says to be a human is to do this set of things in these various places. And you're like, no, actually to be a human is to have this radical freedom to do all kinds of things that we're not supposed to do. And one of those is just moving my stupid little legs over and over again to move me through this space that has no, like, it's a historically very important track, but it has no remnant here.
Right.
And I'm just going to do it and see what I see. And there's this wonderful, as I'm sure you know, there's like, to me, the best part of writing is this kind of information gathering where you're just so radically present. And noticing everything that's there to be noticed from that sign about thief beware to, you know, at one point I start like listing the trash on the side of the road because I'm just like so hyper aware. Everything is interesting to me when I'm in that kind of space.
Right.
So that's the ecstasy of writing to me is getting yourself into those kinds of spaces. The hard part is converting that into text that people can then read. But obviously it's worth it because people often single out that section and what they love about it is what I loved about doing it.
Mm.
So something survives that painful conversion, which is great.
Well, I love
that stupid walk.
I love the description that you give it of radical freedom. That's a nice way to frame it because it's true. I mean, when I'm out on my walks, I think that's a big part of like, I'm almost high when I'm doing these walks. Because it just feels insane that, you know, in a lot of where I'm walking too, depending on the walk, no one else is walking. No one else is doing these walks. It's, you know, I'm doing the equivalent of these land rushes or whatever in Japan because these are old highways that have been you know, asphalted over and they've been turned into actual highways. And so there's trucks and it's just chain stores and stuff. But there is something about just being alone. I find the aloneness is critical. So being alone and just having that autonomy to just, I'm just going to walk. I'm going to go in this shop. I'm not going to go in the shop. There's something there, that heightened awareness of the ability to decide, free will, I guess, out in the middle of nowhere it's intoxicating.
That partly explains the choice of Oklahoma City. Like you said, it's not something people have read a book about before.
Right.
And so in that sense, it's like fresh territory. It's a place I'm not expected to be.
Yeah.
I'm not told to be by anyone. And so it is an exercise of that freedom.
Yeah.
I'm going to write about Oklahoma City. Yeah. So the, for people who don't know, the basic background there is I was sent by the editor of the New York Times Magazine, Hugo Lindgren, at the time. I was standing in his office and we were just kind of casually chatting, and he was like, we need a big, like, colorful cover story from you. Like, what's it going to be about? And I was like, I don't know. And he said, well, you're a basketball fan, right? I said, yeah, I grew up playing basketball. I love thinking about basketball and watching basketball. And he said, what about this team in Oklahoma City? It's a brand new basketball team. They stole a basketball franchise from Seattle, which is an actual city that deserves to have a major sports franchise. Oklahoma City, by almost every standard, does not deserve to have a major sports franchise. How did they get it? Why do they have it? And this team, on top of that, is just a fascinating collection of human beings and personalities. So why don't you go out to Oklahoma City and write about this team and just see what's there to be seen? I was like, yeah, I could do that. That sounds great. So it was just a magazine story. And then I started reading the history of Oklahoma before I went out and encountered things like the land run and the, like, mechanics of how tornadoes happen and why they happen over Oklahoma so relentlessly every year. And something about that combination of material just, like, clicked in me right away. And I was like, oh, this is way more interesting than I expected. And then I had some time on the ground and I was like, okay, this is the place. Like, this is my first book. I'd been waiting. I mean, I'm 42 years old. I was in my mid-30s when I got sent out there. All my life, I've wanted to be, like, hotshot writer guy who writes a cool book, like, and whose magazine pieces turn into books, like Tom Wolfe or something, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I've been waiting. I don't want to just write any shitty old book. I want the book to be really, really, really special.
Right.
And so I'd been waiting all my magazine career, and I'd get these emails from publishers sometimes, like, and I did a cover story and they'd be like, that could be a book. And I'm like, it could be a book, but it's not my book. Right. And so the first time I ever had this feeling of knowing for sure was Oklahoma City. I was like, this is my book. This is the one. And so it felt like this sort of destiny, this, like, certainty and this destiny. And I just wrote, I remember after the original article came out, I just wrote, like, this passionate 2,000 word description of how this would actually be my first book and what I saw there. And that's what got circulated to publishers and got people interested in the project. Yeah.
Well, because in the opening of the book you write, I felt a mysterious inner needle beginning to vibrate, a needle that in all of my journalistic wanderings I had never noticed before. I wasn't sure what it measured or if it measured anything at all, but it was there moving. And I guess that this is what that needle was.
Yeah, see, I said it much better and shorter in writing because I revised it many times. But yeah, it felt like something on the dashboard moving that I hadn't seen move before.
And the 2,000 words, you report on the stolen NBA team, and then you come back and you're like, okay, I'm sort of sold. And then you write this impassioned 2,000 word. Is it like an outline? Is it a summary? Are you going back and forth with your agent about this? And you're saying, hey, I think this might be the one.
Mm-hmm. I told my agent, I said, I think this is the one and here's what I see. And I just wrote this long email. And that became, like, the book proposal. Mm-hmm. And I think based on the excitement in that note and based on my track record as a magazine journalist, publishers were interested. Publishers were surprisingly interested.
Huh.
I never had a conversation where I was convincing someone to publish this book,
which is great. Right.
Yeah.
And so did it go, was there an auction for it? I mean, what was the process like of finding the final home?
Yeah, it was like a montage from a film.
Really?
From an unrealistic film about like a young writer. I wasn't young, but a writer having a great day of success. It was like, oh. I got picked up by this black town car with my agent in it. And then he's like, we've got like 8 meetings at all the leading publishing houses in New York. And it was just a full day of going from meeting to meeting and talking to people about this book. And it felt like everybody was excited. And then before the day was over, before our last meeting, we had like a very nice preemptive offer so that it wouldn't go to auction from one of the publishers, from uh-huh. Crown. So, yeah.
And then that was it. You're like, all right.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the thinking there of keeping it out of auction?
I think Crown had this team who really got it and who really got what I do as a writer. And I think they just wanted to leap in there first and make sure they got the book.
Yeah.
So that I would have my book writing career with them. I think that was the plan.
Wow. And yeah. was your editor to be in the meeting there with you and sort of?
He wasn't. There was a different editor that I started working with at first. Hmm. And then because I take so long to write everything, about halfway through the process, he got a new job with a different publisher.
Right.
So he left and I got handed to a different editor, this guy, Kevin Doughton, who is totally brilliant and had a huge hand in shaping the book into what it turned out to be. Yeah, but it took me five-ish years to write the book, and my original deadline was 1 year.
Oh, my God. Oh, why do they? I think, you know.
Well, there was a vision in the beginning of, I think it was going to be, the original vision was a little bit more like behind the scenes of this NBA team.
Right.
With some interesting local history woven through.
Right.
And of course, my vision exploded
into
something much more galactic and weird than that.
Oh.
And so, yeah, it took 5 years instead of 1. But there was definitely pressure at certain points of like, well, you know, we're kind of drifting away from this season, this like historic season in the NBA that you're writing about.
Right.
I don't know if readers are going to be that into it anymore, like sports readers. And I was like, well, it's not really that book.
Right.
It's kind of this big mythology of all of humankind.
Right. And Crown, you go in and you tell Crown that, and Crown's going, oh, Jesus, what did we sign up for here?
Yeah.
Oh, no, we got one of those writers.
Yeah, it's a 1,200-page multi-volume book called Human Consciousness.
But I'm glad you went galactic on it. I mean, I love, what's the name of the weather reporter?
Gary England.
England. I love England's origin story of born in a wooden shack by the light of a kerosene lamp into the hands of a doctor who, according to family lore, was paid in chickens.
Yeah.
Oh, that's like a line out
classic
of
classic stuff.
Out of a Dennis Johnson novel.
Yeah. So you get on the ground in Oklahoma City and you start talking to people about basketball, and suddenly within 2 minutes you're hearing about Gary England, who is this godlike figure in the Great Plains, the most famous meteorologist in the most like weather intensive place on earth, who's like rescued generations of Oklahomans from death by tornado. And has, you know, played himself in the movie Twister. And like, he's just like this larger than life figure. And there's so many moments like that where I'm like, what is this place? And like just the richness of the local lore, you know, which you would never know. And every place has that kind of thing. Right. And so that's part of what appeals to me about doing a book like this, is it is hyper local, but in that hyper-localness, it becomes universal.
Yeah.
Because every place has figures, outlandishly famous figures in their local space who nobody else has ever heard of,
mm-hmm.
like Gary England.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you just go find Gary England and hang out with him at the weather studio. And like, and it just so happened that while I was with Gary England, the like one of the most epic storms in recorded history came through and like aimed a tornado. It turned out to be the widest tornado in recorded history, over 2 miles wide, directly at Oklahoma City and at the weather studio that I was in with him. And that turned out to be his last tornado of his career. He retired after 40 years.
Oh, my God.
And I was with him at the moment when he, like, staggered out after this, like, 12-hour day of saving people's lives, staggered out of all the monitors and everything, and was just, like, basically, like, I'm done.
Wow.
It's over. Yeah, so all, there were all these moments of what felt like fate in the writing of this book.
Yeah, well, I mean, you feel that reading it, too. I mean, who would have thought meteorology, you just don't think about meteorology. You think it feels like this thing that that's just kind of always been there. There's always been a, you know, a guy predicting what's going to happen tomorrow. You know, is it going to be hot? Is it going to be cold or stormy or whatever? But listening to sort of England's process of kind of creating Doppler, I guess, and you know.
Yeah, he was right there at the cutting edge of all these sort of what we think of as staples of meteorology, of TV weather.
Right,
he was kind of right on the cutting edge of Doppler radar and like the little map in the corner of the screen where you can see weather moving over it. But yeah, his earliest memory of a tornado is this killer tornado that came through rural Oklahoma and killed, I can't remember how many people, but so many people. And he was just like a little kid. Mm. And he remembers like sheltering in a chicken coop with his dad from tornadoes. And like, and when you just had to kind of guess, there'd be a policeman stationed on the edge of town, like watching the sky to warn people that the tornado was coming.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's insane. But I mean, the whole history of the town is insane. And this is like what's, I mean, every page in this book, it's like another thing that's just like beyond ridiculous. Like the fact that they were doing sonic boom testing in Oklahoma City. It's how is that? Like, I feel like that would have been in, you know, that would have been a scene from Watchmen or something. You know, it's like,
you
put it in a movie. You do not actually test sonic booms on a town.
And it's just, that's again, that's like a thing that's just sitting there. I've never heard that story before.
Yeah.
About the U.S. government, the FAA, testing sonic booms systematically over Oklahoma City for 6 months, eight times a day.
That's so insane.
And it's just like there's all those things are sitting out there waiting to be discovered if you just look at the things that you don't already know about, you know?
Yep.
This book really probably dangerously enhanced my belief that everything is interesting. My next book will be about the third floorboard from the left in my dining room. A rich history of it.
I'm sure it has, man.
Yeah, that would work. I mean, that would take you, you know, immediately like back into like late 19th century America and the lumber industry and like all kinds of crap.
Yeah. There, oh man, you're already going. It is faded.
I'm going to write my next book about that picture frame over your left shoulder on my computer screen.
But now that we're kind of talking through this and bringing up like this, almost like this responsibility to just be looking, like just open your eyes and look at the weirdness and the historical strangeness of things. I took a workshop with Alex Chi, and he was talking about this thing he did with, he was in Annie Dillard's class at Wesleyan, and I think
got layers of name dropping going on right now.
I know, it's so, well, I have to, because I want to make sure that the attribution is clean. I don't want any credit for this at all. I'm trying
Annie Dillard, who I haven't mentioned but is one of my absolute heroes and who I read all the time for inspiration and like how to find like ecstasy in small things.
So good. So unbelievably fucking good. I do the same thing. Anytime I'm trying to get into even like a mildly creative place, Annie is one of my go-tos. Just because, you know, she's doing what you're saying. I mean, you know, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, it's just, look, just go to your freaking pond and be open. Be open to the stuff that's happening at the pond. Anyway, but in her class, apparently, one of the assignments was write about your hometown, but you have to research it like you've never been to that town before. Because Alex's whole thing, the reason why he brought that up was he's like, look, you know, a lot of autobiographical fiction, you know, that's fine. You write about bits of your life. But the trap that people fall into is that they think they know their life when they right. don't. And so you right. you assume, oh, I know exactly what's going on here, but start to poke at that veneer, and it's like there's mm-hmm. this whole rich, insane universe beneath it. So anyway, invariably, Annie's students would, you know, come back and be kind of totally mesmerized by what they had found about their hometown.
And that's, reading Annie Dillard is another great example of like the kind of freedom
yeah.
I'm looking for in life, because our popular culture is never going to steer you to a paragraph of Annie Dillard.
Right.
And a paragraph of Annie Dillard could change your entire life and could change like the fabric of your mind, and you're just never going to find it.
Yeah.
And I remember that all the time when I just like sit down with a book, or I sit down even, you know, writing in my own journal. It's like there's no outside force that's pushing me toward that thing. And so it does become this little act of rebellion that I find very exciting.
Yeah.
What the culture wants you to do right now is to refresh feeds on your phone.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's where a lot of money is flowing. It's not flowing through the Annie Dillard paragraph.
You got to break the loops.
But pick up like An American Childhood and read, you know, one of the short little chapters, you know, about the time she was throwing snowballs with her friends and hit a windshield of a car driving by. The guy got out and chased them all through the neighborhood. And it was like the most like exhilarating and like clarifying thing that has ever happened to her.
Wow.
It's just like she does these things in the space of like two pages
yeah.
that will stick with you for the rest of your life. And no one's ever going to point you toward it, which is kind of a great crime of our culture, I think.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to point. I've definitely quoted Annie a few times and stuff that I've kind of put out there. I think I have a weird audience. I have a very strange cross-section of folks reading my stuff. And I kind of see it as an opportunity to kind of cross-pollinate these very disparate mm-hmm. worlds. And so mm-hmm. I definitely reach for Annie. But like in her... you know, her Eclipse essay, you know, that the Atlantic
oh my God.
Republished a couple of years ago.
It, the greatest.
It's so incredible. And the way she describes this clown painting in her room.
The clown painting made of vegetables.
Made of
yeah.
vegetables that you could never forget it. You know, she talks about never unseeing it. You know, it's mm-hmm. something, she describes it as like something that you'd never desire to look at. But once you've seen it, you can never unsee. You know, it's
just, yeah. And that's the beginning of this
yeah.
deep spiritual epic about witnessing a full eclipse. And she begins it with this stupid painting in her motel room that she can't stop unseeing. And that's, again, that's another kind of perfect act of, like, freedom. Because that would get cut by 99 editors out of 100.
Well, that...
If you put that essay in a magazine... In a magazine, they'd be like, eh, we got to get to the eclipse. I like this clown stuff. It's beautifully written, right. but I think we just need to get the reader like right into.
So who else do you go to for that feeling, that sense of freedom or whatever, that kind of inspiration?
It was really essays that did it for me. Like when I was a teenager, I knew I wanted to be kind of like that feverish moment of middle adolescence, like age 15, where you sort of try to reinvent yourself. I decided I wanted to be literary guy, and I wanted to be like great writer guy. And I think that came from growing up surrounded by stories of various kinds. My mom was a great storyteller, and my dad was a big like sci-fi fantasy reader. And I was always just good with words. And I always was good at reading, like academically. Mm. And so I think that's how I decided, like, this will be my identity. I'll be reader guy. And I got really into Dostoevsky. And I would like walk around town reading The Brothers Karamazov, like literally on the sidewalk of suburban Lodi, California. on the way to school reading The Brothers Karamazov.
Right.
And I'd like sit in class sullenly in the back reading My Brothers Karamazov. And so I thought that's what it meant to be a writer. And you wrote big novels. And I would write, like, I tried to write fiction. And I was really bad at it. And it felt very, like, forced and dutiful. And then in college, just browsing through libraries, I started to discover this whole other tradition of essay writing.
Mm.
And it's like a lot of the old New Yorker writers, E.B. White, mm-hmm. Thurber, Dorothy Parker, a lot of whom were really funny. There was like this little subgenre of humor writing that I completely fell in love with. And I used to write a humor column in the college newspaper. And it felt like literary, but also very close to the voice that was in my head and very close to like the kind of jokey gamesmanship we would stand around and do in high school as a group of friends, you know, where you just tell dumb jokes, like lines of jokes that were related with dumb puns and all that stuff. And it was like there was a form of like there's just like this obsession with like holding people's attention and with being like interesting and funny and clever. And I found that in this old humor writing. Mm-hmm. And I got really into that. And then that led into the personal essay, which, as we were just talking about with the eclipse, like, has this radical freedom inside of it. You can write about anything and in any way you want to, as long as you're holding the reader's interest somehow, as long as you're being like kind of authentic and interesting. So I loved that challenge and it felt very natural to me.
Mm.
And that's where everything kind of took off for me. So I love the old timey essayists. I still love a lot of those New Yorker writers. I love John McPhee. Mm. I think John McPhee became for me like this model of the totally curious mind out in the world.
Right, and
McPhee, again, a legend of writing about subjects that should not be interesting.
Right,
like he famously wrote this book called Oranges.
The title is Oranges.
And it's about oranges and the history of like humans eating oranges and like the orange industry in Florida.
Right.
Yeah.
Or the geological formations out west. You know, just kind of.
Yeah. Annals of the Former World.
Yes.
Which he won the Pulitzer Prize for, which is a collection of his four books, I think, on the geology of the formation of North America.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's amazing. There's one of them early on in that. There's a he has a dream. Do you know this passage where he has a dream that like explains geology?
No.
I'll send it to you. Right. He has a dream about like an ice cream shop. There's a fire at an ice cream shop and the wall collapses and there's like a rug store next door and the rugs come tumbling in and all these layers are sort of, I'll send it to you. It's just such a fresh, bizarre, creative way to explain what many people think of as a boring subject.
Right.
And you read that paragraph and you're like, oh shit, yeah, that's how geology works. Like, that's how North America was formed.
Right.
This stupid dream about an ice cream shop lighting on fire and being buried under a carpet shop.
I have this beautiful old Pine Barrens edition.
Oh, I love that book.
So good. And it's like,
yeah,
you know, that's another thing. I mean, but, you know, McPhee is funny. It's so funny hanging out with him as he does these, you know, ostensibly really boring adventures, right? I mean, he's
really funny in a sly way. I have this whole thing. I want to write an essay. I wrote a profile of McPhee, which was one of my sort of crowning life achievements, was to get to hang out with John McPhee and now like exchange letters with John McPhee. My whole jag about McPhee, John McPhee should win the Nobel Prize in Literature.
Yeah.
John McPhee should be the leading American contender for the Nobel Prize in Literature. If you go back and read through his books, and actually when I got the book contract to do Boomtown, I thought, all right, it's time to get serious. It's time to like marinate my brain in the possibilities of great literary nonfiction. Yeah. And I started reading John McPhee from the beginning of his career. And I think I read through 13 of his books before I had to like give up because it was too demoralizing. He's too good. His style was sort of like infecting my brain. Right. And like, I'm such a different writer than he is.
Right.
So I had to let it go. But I read a ton of John McPhee. And part of what I realized is like, he's one of the great American experimental writers. People think of him because they associate him with journalism, with boring subjects. They think of him as kind of stodgy and staid.
Yeah.
he's as experimental as like Tom Wolfe and the quote unquote new journalists. He's just not like tap dancing about it constantly and self-promoting. But you read anything by him and the structures. Have you read his book on writing?
Yeah.
Draft number four.
Draft number four. The one essay was just called Structure, right, for the New Yorker that he did a couple years ago.
And his Paris Review interview is legendary and something I return to all the time for inspiration. Just the amount of creativity that goes into choosing a subject and choosing a structure. Yeah, I got to write that manifesto of John McPhee should win the Nobel Prize. I think there's I think there's kind of a prejudice against journalistic nonfiction or things that start in magazines.
Yeah.
But he's as good as any literary writer out there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and your David Engels piece is so it's just so much fun. David's ankles. Who'd have thought that writing about this statue? I mean, admittedly, it's an important statue, but just keeping it up. Just keeping that thing from falling over, and then you know, the fake one being out in the square and the real one being in the back, and yada yada yada, and just it's just such a joy to go on that weird adventure into the world of why do we even care that the original has to be saved, right? I mean, there's this kind of, everyone's going to the square thinking that the replica is the original anyway.
Why? I know.
Why? But it's like, you start to go, all these things start to burble up when you start to, look and drill down on a single angle or two.
Yeah, I think that's like, that's like the principle of meditation or something. You sit quietly and observe something and there's this incredible richness and complexity and like calmness that comes over you. That's how I feel when I get into paying attention to a place or a thing to write about it.
Mm.
I wish I could transfer that sense of excitement and richness and creativity into the writing itself. And sometimes I can, but it's just surrounded by this like horrible electric fence of anxiety.
Yeah.
I think probably because I care too much. Like if my superpower as a writer is like caring, then it brings with it this downside of I don't know, wanting the finished thing to be so good. I guess that's just perfectionism, like caring too much. That's what perfectionism is. So I got to figure out that part of it.
I was watching a video interview with Daido Moriyama, some old school Japanese photographer. And he's put out like, 200 books, 300 books. He's just put out an insane number of books. And there was this interview with him, and it was like a little documentary, and it was showing him laying out a new book. And the guy was just so fast. Mm. Like, it wasn't that he didn't care, but there was no preciousness about it at all. And it's like, okay, yeah, that's how you get to 200, 300 books, is you just gotta,
I really struggle with that. I would love to be able to be that way, but then also not.
Right. I mean, the question,
when people say perfect, people say this phrase, perfect is the enemy of the good, which I think about a lot, because undoubtedly my overcaring about the final product and needing every like sentence to be special, undoubtedly that has reduced my output into the world by like 80%+.
Right.
Which is a problem. But I also have a really high confidence that what is out there is special. And I like that. And I think, like I was saying, like, I don't want to ask people to sit down and read stuff that's just like pretty good. You know?
Yeah.
I want, if I'm asking someone to sit down to write, to read something I've written, I want there to be this contract that like it's absolutely going to be worth it every time.
Right.
And I always think of this phrase, perfect is the enemy of the good. And I'm kind of like, well, yeah, Because the perfect is better than the good. I mean, and,
they should be.
And the good is the enemy of the perfect. Like, if I get a good draft, like, I can actually get it all the way to where I don't want to change anything. And that's kind of perfect to me. And right. I can get there. So why wouldn't I get there?
Well, also, how many books do you need to do in a life? Like, what?
I don't know. That's a great question.
You know,
let's get my book editor on the line. He wants me to do more.
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, the deadline just helps push stuff along a little bit, you know.
Right. And once again, we've come back to like the most boring cliche you could ever say. Well, it helps to have a deadline.
It does.
You know, you just got to get that imperfect version out first, and then you can work on it making it better. It's like David Foster Wallace wrote about this, and I mean, that was a big part of Infinite Jest, was like how humiliatingly cliched all these deep truths from like AA are, you know, from like addiction recovery. It's just like, that's part of the problem. Right. It's like one day at a time.
Yeah.
And it turns out these little truisms are the absolute like bedrock truth of human experience. God damn it.
No great insights today. You know, whatever, like 150,000 words last year, kind of pushed through these newsletters or what. But for me, that was helpful, even though it's not 150,000 like words that I'm super, super proud of. But
okay. Yeah. What's your relationship to that?
So I see that more as essentially exercising the muscle. I have a really hard time.
Yeah.
I have a really hard time keeping everything, behind the curtain, private, like in terms of writing. Like I worked on a book for years and it's not out in the world, and I've written 500,000 words around it, you know, in various different forms, you know, and I found that was not a super healthy place for me to exist all the time. And so I've found that this kind of schedule for me has been useful to get these kind of, you know, okay to good, sometimes, you know, maybe really fun chunks out there in the universe. And I suspect just a lot of people aren't reading them. Like, people just don't read all the newsletters. So the way I've been able to kind of push down the anxiety around that is I go, okay, great. This is like, just get these drafts done, get these things out there. And then we're going to go back and setting up another deadline of having, I want to do two sort of consolidations a year where I'm just, I'm consolidating. I've got this book format set up and I can just push out this physical object that's kind of from, you know, from that reservoir of stuff. And that can be the thing I point at and go, okay, look, this has come through your inbox probably in the last, you know, 6 to 18 months. But here, I've given it another coat of paint, and actually I've put it in a form where you can focus on it and you're not distracted and pulled in a million different. So that to me, like knowing that system's in place makes me okay with kind of putting more stuff out there than is absolutely perfect.
Mm-hmm.
That's been my hack.
Okay.
I'm still in the middle of it, you know, very early days of this hack, but.
Mm-hmm.
But that,
I like that though.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird. I mean, it's my own weird, I wouldn't really recommend it, but it's my own, it's my own strange.
I mean, part of what terrifies me about myself is I feel like I could go silent forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like I could absolutely keep all of that inside forever.
Inside as you mean like you're writing at home and it's, you're just not showing it to people, or?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Forever.
Yep.
I could never finish a project again. Yeah. Absolutely.
Right.
1,000%. This phrase keeps recurring to me over the last however many months. Is like, I am a monster of detachment. I'm able to detach to a degree that's kind of ridiculous. And so that scares me about myself. Yeah, my sister and I do this thing we call turtling, where we just like go into the shell and like sink down to the bottom into the mud at the bottom of the lake, and like you can just be fine forever. It doesn't matter what anxiety is going on around you, we can completely detach. I think, you know, We don't need to get too deep into my childhood here, but I think we learned some of that in childhood.
Do you think?
And I can still do that. And I want to not do that because, like I said, I believe in this, in humans being humans and interacting with each other as like full humans. And I think it's a really positive, wonderful thing. And I think writing can do a lot of that work. So I don't want to just detach and turtle
right. And
sink into the mud. So I got to figure out ways to be better about getting it out. New Sentences was good, but then, like I said, that died because nobody cared about it. They just canceled it. But they just redesigned the front of the magazine and just took it out.
But you would have kept going on it.
Yeah.
You would have stuck with it.
Well, yeah, but again, it took an external deadline to make me actually do it and produce it.
Right.
So that's the question, is like how to writing for me, because when you're truly radically open to paying attention to something, the input is just enormous. The level of detail that you gather, I mean, on that walk through Oklahoma City, I tallied so many pieces of garbage I can't even tell you. And in the book, that comes out as like, you know, six funny ones or something, like a nice little series.
Right.
But in reality, that meant cutting 90% of what I had gathered from that walk, or more than 90%, and radically remaking what I chose to write down.
Mm.
And it takes an almost like geological pressure and heat to do that transformation of material from the world into a polished piece of writing. And the question then is how to generate that geological pressure and heat without, like, can it only truly be generated by deadline pressure and like the threat of humiliation and like losing your job if you don't finally finish this thing? Or can you generate it internally, privately somehow, in a way that's not like traumatic to you? That's the big question.
Right.
Email me the answer.
The traumaticness.
If you don't know right now.
I mean, the very definition of pressure is. You know, like something on the back end, a backstop to whatever's going on. You know, the geological pressure is the stuff bumping into each other. You know, if there's no other rock to bump into, it just keeps moving.
And the like crazy heat that is coming from the center of the earth that cannot be suppressed.
Right. Well, it's bumping against the rock. Yeah. It's pushing up.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You need those things. I don't know. I find I need them. I've given up on self-generating these pressures or whatever.
But you haven't, because you self-generate the pressures. You like create little systems that generate the pressures.
Well, I build up enough energy to create the system, and then the system is there and it forces me to do me to do the things. So but I don't know, again, like you said, nothing new here. Nothing no one else has
totally
struggled with.
Which again is what makes it powerful, is that we're all, especially on self-quarantine, surrounded by screens, surrounded by predatory attention loops, we're all suffering through these obvious things that are hard to fix.
Well, I found about 3 days ago, so I'm like 10 days into the quarantine. And, you know, and the weird thing about Japan is that actually nothing is going on here right now. There's like none of my Japanese friends are quarantining or sheltering in place or worrying or staying out of bars and restaurants. I mean, I have been kind of almost out of a sense of like solidarity with everyone else I know in the world. I've been taking myself out of the equation here, but I don't think I need to. Anyway, it's creating this really weird dissonance of Europe and America being so extreme in one direction, and then kind of Taiwan, Japan, Hong Kong being the other direction, Singapore, you know, just not being too crazy. But this is, so anyway, it's about 10 days into this thing and of like the real lockdown stuff starting in America. And about 3 days ago, I crested the limit of reading about this shit. I just hit some lid, some pot of addictive garbage inside of me got full, and I'm not into it anymore. And I could, I started doing what I'd consider like real work again, just 3 days ago. I don't know. Have you felt any, ebb and flow of the loops or?
Yeah, because the news, well, only when the news gets less interesting and it feels like it's not changing fast enough. Mm. Or no, I mean, I build in habits to get myself away from it. Like, here's a nice habit I have developed over the last couple months is instead of when I'm making coffee in the morning, instead of listening to a podcast, which to me is like a half step away from reading Twitter.
Yep.
It's still like a phone-based mind occupier, mind pirate. I listen to jazz, which is something I know almost nothing about.
Yeah.
And I have this little stupid little ritual now where directly next to my little speakers is a book I bought in Japan at Kinokuniya, a sort of hip Kinokuniya jazz satellite, I think, near a university. And it's a book by Haruki Murakami of little essays in Japanese, I can't read them, about his favorite jazz artists and jazz albums.
Yep.
And there are paintings in it of all the different jazz people he talks about. And so I flip to a random page and I just put on Spotify that album.
Okay.
And I play that while I make my coffee.
Right.
And that feels very like intentional and outside of the phone loop.
Right, right. That's pretty complicated.
So that's a way I can start my day. It's actually not complicated. It took me a long time to explain, but you just flip the book open and you put on a jazz album. And then you have music while you're playing while you're making your coffee instead of the Daily or Reply All or whatever podcast I'm going to put on.
Yeah, no, I find podcasts activate the same thing in my head as like browsing the internet in a lot of cases. Not all. But like the news stuff, it just puts you in that that mode. I'm the same. I wake up and music and making breakfast, making coffee. And yeah, definitely not. I mean, what's so dangerous now is you can ask all the smart speakers to just play, you know, hey, what's the latest news? And it gives you the little news snippet. And that I find also kind of pulls you away. But the Murakami thing, you have a whole history of, you went and visited Murakami. Didn't you go on a run with him?
Yeah.
<I did. laughs> down in Oiso.
That's right.
In his home, a little hometown, or where he lives in Japan.
Yeah. Yep. I got to hang out with him for a day at his office in Tokyo. And then the following day I met him there and his assistant drove us to his home. And we chatted in the drive and then had this beautiful sushi lunch that he had prepared for us. And then we sat in his office upstairs where he does all of his writing and has his vast record collection, floor-to-ceiling shelves of vinyl, and these huge speakers that I think he bought from eBay. And I said, can we listen to some music? And he said, of course. He writes so much about music. And so we listened to like all these key albums from his life, like the first album he ever bought and his favorite jazz album and the Janacek Symphony that was in 1Q84. And one of the great things about it actually was, I was like, oh, can we listen to this Sinfonietta, the Janacek that sort of recurs constantly through 1Q84. He's like, yes. So he puts it on and we sit down to listen and he turns the volume knob up almost as high as it goes. And these speakers are like as tall as a person and we're just completely drenched in this music. And I thought we were going to like turn this on in the background and chat, but no, we sat and we listened to that music and it was amazing.
Yeah.
And like whenever he turned something on, he turned it on. Wow. And we sat and we bathed in the music.
Man, that's
it was cool.
That, what a great experience. And I mean, that's a guy who he produces. He gets stuff out.
I mean, and he's one of those great models of willpower where when he decided he would be a writer,
boom,
he boom, he's going to bed at 9 o'clock. He's waking up at 4 a.m. He's eating only healthy food that he makes for himself from then on.
Yep. Stop smoking.
Yeah. Yeah, and started seriously running. Yep. So he writes for, 4 hours or something and then takes a break and goes for a 6-mile slow jog through Oiso.
Yeah.
Which I did with him. Not the whole thing, but we did a portion of it. It was great.
Yeah. I mean, I have friends who have stories about, he'll be at like a book event and there'll be a line of people waiting to get signatures or something, or he'll finish signing and the publisher will be like, hey, let's take you out for dinner. And he'll be like, it's 9 p.m. Sorry, I got to go home. I have to go to bed.
I really admire that. Just I would like to be that way.
Relentlessly.
And I have
committed.
Been in the past. When I actually wrote Boomtown, I took book leave from the Times Magazine for, I think, like 8 months. Mm. And was like, well, I cannot waste this time.
Yeah.
And so I would get to my office I would do what I called the Haruki plan. I would get to my office by 5 a.m. every morning.
Really?
And then, yeah. And then I would just write. Yeah. My wife was like, yeah, go ahead. She's like, if you'll do me the favor of like making our kids lunches the night before, then I'll take care of the kids in the morning, get them off to school, and you just go write. And so I did, and I was very disciplined about it, and I would end up, some days I'd write for like 12 hours and
holy
was
moly.
Going crazy. But a lot of the, and that was 8 months, and then it took me another 4 years on top of that. But a lot of the writing that I did early on, a lot of the land run stuff came out of that really intense, really focused session.
Wow, that's so 8 months. And was it like 5 days a week, or did you go on vacation at all?
It was 5 days a week, and yeah, there were. I've always been very available to my family. We have 2 kids. Our daughter's 15. Our son is 12. So I had kids, I don't know, semi young, and given the flexibility of my job, I've always been able to like be around for them. And I like that a lot. That's super important to me. So I probably wasn't doing the full Haruki.
Right.
But a partial Haruki.
Yeah. I mean, cause you interviewed him and then I guess you started the Boomtown maybe like two or three years later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I started running for that too, for that story. I always hated jogging.
Okay.
But I thought, well, if I'm going to profile Haruki Murakami, then you got to get into his headspace, and jogging is so important to him. So I started jogging while listening to the music that he listens to while he jogs. And I lost like 20 pounds and it was great.
Wow. But you didn't keep it up.
Ouch. That's another burn, because you're looking at me on the camera and you're like,
I mean,
not like I used to when I got into it for that story. Again, for a story, I can like super commit to anything.
Right.
And I was jogging like 5 days a week or something. I still jog, but not that often.
Right. I mean, you have a runner's physique. I mean, that's obvious.
Thanks, man.
That's obvious. I just didn't know if you're still doing like marathons or not.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
Anyway, all right. Well, I think this is pretty good. We got like an hour and a half.
Okay. We just talked about everything.
I think we covered it all. Annie Dillard, yeah. John McPhee, Boomtown, David's Ankles, a little bit of Rick Steves. Thanks, Sam, for making time to chat today.
My pleasure. You actually got me out of bed nice and early so I can go do some writing. Maybe this will kickstart me waking up early again.
There you go.
Because it's hard to get out of bed early, especially when you're feeling like defeated and depressed and like a big loser and you haven't been productive. Then it's just kind of sleep till 9:30.
Yeah. Well, and especially, I guess, if your kids aren't going to school and everything's shut down and no one has any structure.
But maybe this will kickstart me into waking up.
There you go.
Earlier. Maybe your weird Japan time will kickstart me into a new loop of productivity.
Anyway, Sam, good luck to both of us.
Good luck to everybody out there.
There it is, an episode, a new episode. Can you believe it? I can't. Barely. I can barely believe it. And not only that, but we have a follow-up. Boom. A 1-2 punch of pods. I know. It's almost too much to bear. So keep your pod player going. And it should queue up the Sam and Craig follow-up, a.k.a. Season 2, Episode 2 of On Margins, recorded some 10 months after this episode. Which brings me to our sponsor for the show, actually, Procrastination. That beautiful sadist invoked by all of us creative masochists to come and crush our souls in the deep of the night, to force our hand to do literally anything besides the creative work we should be doing. Thanks, Procrastination, for stepping up and giving us the opportunity to almost never release this episode. And thanks to all the members of my Special Projects membership program. Yeah, I got a membership program, man. I know. They're everywhere. But Special Projects has been going since 2019, and it is truly the driving force behind being able to do work like this. So if you enjoyed this pod, consider joining. It sends a big signal to me that I should be procrastinating less around this stuff and putting together more of these pods. So join at craigmod.com/membership. Thanks.